Arnie has regrettably been called out of town due to a death in the family, and Jeff had a prior commitment that he was unable to get out of. So in spite of that, the committee will continue to do its work. I will hand the gavel to our august vice chair and invite Representative Bates, Cruz, and Westland to the witness podium for a presentation on our work groups.
Mr. Chair, this should really be good.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, I would like to take a moment to apologize for my lateness. I was locked up with seven dentists and their accessories to try to work out a compromise on a difficult bill.
And your teeth look surprisingly white.
Very little.
Oh, is that the...
But I do apologize.
Right, I'm not asking
apologize.
Any questions.
Could you remind us to...
Yes, thank you. And be sure to sign in for the record and pull the microphones very close for the listening audience. And since there's only two microphones, it probably, since the last member arriving, will probably not get to speak much.
Lucky guy.
For the record, I am Representative Ben Westland, chair of the committee I am testifying before. With me, I obviously have Representatives Cruz and Bates. And we want to, as best as we possibly can, bring the committee up to date on what has transpired in some very productive work groups, both Oregon Health Plan and mental health. Let's begin with Oregon Health Plan, and let me call your attention to this document that you should all have copies of. And just ask you to flip over to the second page to refresh yourself. With our box. The top box goes back to the governor's recommended or governor's balanced budget, where it shows we have $590 million in general fund and 401 in tobacco funds. Run that all the way out and you get the total funds, the federal funds, and the total funds budget. What the Oregon Health Plan group decided to do was start out at basic bare bedrock and cost a federal Medicaid minimum program. That is the bolded number in terms of state general fund and tobacco dollars that the mandatory population would cost, $846.1 million. That's my good news. My bad news is that based on recent economic forecasts and trends that I think everyone will agree with, it's, as Barney would say, a Kentucky windage number that we better take 10% off of the general fund the governor spent, the 590 in the top box. So you've got to subtract $59 million off the 145.9, and I'm hoping Representative Bates is doing the math.
Wait, where's the 145?
145 is right between. That's how much money we have left over if you purchase the federal Medicaid minimum plan.
Point that over here, please.
I don't think it was typed into this.
It's above the third box.
Oh, there.
Oh, okay.
Second and third box.
I see where you're talking about.
Right down here.
Right here.
145.
Got it. Okay.
In other words, what we're doing there is taking the dollars that the governor spent in his balanced budget, costing out mandatory minimum Medicaid program, which cost us $846, the difference or the gap is 100 and, let's call it 146 million, 145.9. Okay, that's my good news.
No, I'm sorry. Tell me again what the 145.9 is.
That's the difference between, and this is a positive number, that's the difference between the governor's balanced budget,
the
992.
Okay, gotcha.
And the 846.
Gotcha.
Leaves us 145.9. My bad news is that that was back in the salad days when the governor proposed the 992 program, and so we've got to take, and this is a Kentucky windage number to use Barney's phrase, we've got to take about 10% off the general fund, the 590, so you take 59 million off that 145.9 and it leaves 85.9.
Do you understand where he got that figure?
Yes.
If you go on the general fund on top at 590, take 90% of that, and you add the tobacco tax to the next column, you'll get 992, you get about 931. And you subtract the 846 in Boltrum from the 931, leaving about 85, 86 million. That's in real dollars, if the revenue forecast is what we really expect. Not necessarily the governor's. And the governor's expectations have already been lowered closer to this, too, I believe.
And I'd also point out that in the second box, the bold at 846 is really 786.
Yeah.
Say,
why didn't you?
What is 786, please?
The 846, the bolded
is
subtotal,
really seven?
Is really 786.
Okay.
What's some assumption?
I mean, you know, we just made an assumption of reduction, and we're doing ballparks, and we're not trying to do decimal points. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
should it okay if we just sort of ask questions?
Absolutely. Go ahead. Let's.
I don't need to do any more, but I just noticed that I went directly.
Well, that's fine, and that's given our the group here.
Maybe we should explore the 786 camp.
Well, we insist on protocol.
the 786. What you're doing is you had to take...
Please identify yourself.
I'm State Representative Jeff Cruz, District 7, co-conspirator. You know, if you take the general fund, the governor's general fund budget, and you take 10% away, take that down to 530, then any other totals you have in the second box, the 846, is a... When you take out the non-OHP, this is... The 846 is the total of general fund and tobacco, okay? But you still have to take the same 60 million out.
Well, actually not, because that the if as I read the mandatory program, that tells us what would be the bare minimum required to continue the existing program. So we still need 846. We just don't. We're not putting. We don't have as much left over for options.
Let me offer a complication.
And that's Representative Bates.
This is Representative Bates, House District 5. What Representative Cruz, I believe, is trying to let us know is that in that 846 number is included the cost of not having a prescription drug benefit. That drives up the cost in other areas, emergency room visits, hospitalization, and so forth. If you buy back the prescription cost, the prescription benefit down below, you end up with a number of about 786 to run the program up above. Now that's kind of, I know that's kind of counterintuitive. Let me run that past you again. And Jeff, are you?
Well, yeah, I mean,
you're right. I mean, your numbers are right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you don't have the bottom block, if you only have OHP, non-OHP, and total mandatory program, the mandatory program does not include a pharmacy benefit for these people. Does not include any of the other issues down here. Does not include any of the other issues down here. The key one being the pharmacy benefit. If you buy back the pharmacy benefit, it lowers at 846 to about 786.
Got it.
Okay, so it's kind of like flip-flopping this thing. So you do pick up some some of the cost of the prescription drug benefit by actually having it, but not enough to close the gap. So if you assume you're going to have a prescription drug benefit, you can take and make that 846 number 786, which then gives you a different number for 931. But you can't count it again down below. Okay?
And in reality, would we also have to, if we're subtracting $59 million, we would in theory be subtracting it at the top and out of the top box under
correct
at the 590 range, which
right.
means
right.
so our 992 is not 992 anymore. It's in the
932,
right,
which results in a corresponding loss of federal funds because we're not putting as much state and other
right.
funds in.
Yeah, you can run all these out of you can run all these out to the fourth last column and see what your loss in federal funds are. We stuck with general funds because that's our universe. We have to know what are general funds available and how far can we stretch them. So what we really looked at was a $153,21,27,11 million that we have to raise in order to cover what is considered a normal package for these people. And we had to do it out of $85 million.
Or in really simple terms, you can look at the top box as revenue, the middle box as what you absolutely fundamentally have to do, the line between the second and third as the difference, which is about $85 million, and then the third box down four crucial buyback areas that we don't think that any health plan can substantially do without.
The only difference there is the fact that the middle box on this chart also includes the numbers from PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is utilization and reimbursement and behavioral offset and for RX, things like that. That's how we factor into a different number as a bottom line there.
But go ahead, Mr.
And that number appears then under the other funds category, basically?
Well,
It's just offset and cost. If you don't have a pharmaceutical benefit, your hospital costs are going to be going up.
They assume a 30% increase. Yeah.
So that, nobody explained what the how the offset right. really worked.
And that, I mean, that's just one of them.
Yeah.
But
okay,
we're kind of getting more detailed than I think we need to for this presentation. Again, top box is revenue, middle box is what our cost is, and third box is mandatory buybacks that we think are essential. Those total functionally $203 million. Okay.
Except there's some savings in the hospitalization part.
Correct.
Okay, so bottom line.
That is an offset. If you took, the bottom line, if there wasn't behavioral offset in the second box, you would theoretically add another $30 million to RX. But rather than add it, we keep it at that number and assume that when we add it in to the middle box.
Well, let me ask the question a different way. We're assuming that a mandatory plan and a bare basic plan would include, that any kind of plan we wanted to offer would include the four items in the lower box and the mandatory services.
Right.
All right. How much general fund do we need to do that?
Not much.
Flip.
Before we flip, Mr. Chair.
Can I ask a question before you leave?
I asked first.
Representative,
get control of this committee.
They answer my question. Representative Tomei is next.
Thank you.
You started to say the answer is on another page.
The answer is on. Now flip back to the
first
page of this. I just wanted to reacquaint us back with where we gone, what you'd seen before. Okay, the answer to that question is if you buy back all of those four benefits in the lower box, we need $127 million.
That's what I was after. So the $127 million is those buybacks?
Right.
The third box, correct?
The 127 is what we are short based on the governor's budget of funding everything that was in the second and third box.
Including the 85 surplus. I mean, we've got over $200 million worth of benefits here. We're going to take the $85 million that we had, the gap, mm-hmm. the positive gap, away from that $200-some-odd, and we're going to come up with, we need $127 million additional to buy those four benefits back.
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlink.
I thought the 145 stays there because you've reduced the 992 to 931 and the 846 to 786. That still leaves you 145,000.
No, it doesn't, because what's not on this sheet is our Kentucky windage number.
Is the
10% functionally $59-60 million. So you really don't have up in the top box, you really don't have $992 million of general fund and tobacco tax. You've got $932 million.
No, well, I was saying 931 minus 786.
Well, okay.
Gives you 145.
Let's throw the 786 out for now then.
Oh, okay.
I mean that's
okay.
Kind of that, I think and I apologize, I took
yes.
this a place a little bit beyond this, what we needed to be discussing here. So,
okay. But with the 786, you still have 100.
It's not the first time, Representative, but I'm sure it won't be the last.
Okay.
And if I can follow up before you leave this table, did anybody ever find the elusive missing OF 100 million, or it's actually 80 million?
The what?
The other fund money.
Not
the other
yet.
Funded money.
Actually, yeah.
Okay, it's you know where it is somewhere. Right?
Hold on. All right, I'm saying no. Bates is saying yes. You've got to answer the question.
John Britton.
Yeah, we did find it.
And John Britton and I discussed this, and I frankly can't remember the answer right now. I should have written it down and given you a memo on it, and I will do that.
But
it was a combination of Medicare. Let me go check it out again.
Well, I just wanted to find out if you get something
real.
Back when you start putting back the bottom thing.
It is appropriately accounted for, and the numbers you're seeing here are appropriate.
Okay.
We don't know what it is. We don't know where it goes, but we know it wasn't misappropriated.
I just trust you. You're a doctor. I trust you.
And I've
I was searching for a second opinion myself.
Just for the record, Representative got Bates lost in the tunnel.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. Are these figures based on projected eligibles or eligibles that we have right now?
They're based on the projected eligibles halfway through the next biennium.
Thank you.
Yeah, made by
before. Yeah, that is on the third page. There is a list of the categorical eligibles on that third page of the handout.
Third page of this document. This is, you know, who's left in and functionally who's cut out.
The first top of that box are all the categorically eligible people.
Yeah. All right, you can see from the bolded numbers. We'll end up covering about 350,000 and 150,000 who are currently on or otherwise would have been eligible will be removed.
Yeah.
Great. So to sum up, let me try to summarize it how I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and even if I'm right, I'm sure you will. If we wish to continue the Oregon Health Plan as it is somewhat constructed now with our list, with our waiver structure, using we're going back to basic Medicaid?
There is no list. There is no waiver.
Well,
we are... until they kick us off, which they probably will because we haven't expanded the population. We have no list to overlay on this. This is functionally a defined benefits program. We just talked to the Health Services Commission, in fact, the three of us, not more than 2 hours ago, and explained that to them, much to their consternation. Now, there are some things we can do, but that gets a little bit further down the trail. After we get done with our work here, we will then involve ourselves in, you know, crafting, you know, either an amendment to the waiver, which I would anticipate we will overlay the list on top of the defined benefits package, or the mandatory minimum population.
The reality is, under the current waiver, we could do theoretically what we're proposing here, because what would happen is what's already happening, and the plans are dropping standard, and so all those people are still eligible, but they become fee for service and they don't get service. But under the current waiver, we could not afford, in the budget we currently have, we don't have enough money under the current waiver to do the match necessary to cover the population with the four categories there. Right now, if we did absolutely nothing at all, we'd go back to basic Medicaid with a little bit of RX, because that's all that's in the budget.
Representative, what four categories are you referring to?
Back to the page two. That would be the drugs, durable medical.
Thank you. Got it.
Technically, theoretically, we might be able to get away with it under the current waiver. But what we're looking at is the fact that we need to craft something that's going to allow us to go beyond what the current waiver allows and be sustainable and expandable. And so, go ahead, Alan.
I'd like to step back just for a minute and explain how we got the waiver, why we have the waiver, and why the waiver is in jeopardy at this point. The waiver, in very simple terms, is based on the idea that we would be allowed for the first time to limit the benefit to the mandatory population. There's never been a limit on that prior to Oregon doing it. Now, many other states have it now. So we would limit the benefits, and which was done in a very logical fashion. You limit those benefits. And then, as a trade-off for that, the federal government said, if you limit the benefits, you can expand. We want expansion of the population. If you don't expand the population, we would assume, they'd say the opposite is now in case, you don't get to have your waivers. The constraints placed on us by the budget are such that we can offer, without a waiver, a basic mandatory program, which is physician coverage, or provider coverage, I should say, hospital coverage, and that's about it. You are not required under a federal mandatory to have a prescription drug coverage, just as you are not in Medicare, medical supplies, mental health, or addiction services. None of those are mandatory under a normal federal Medicaid program. There are certain minimal standards you have to meet as far as an eligible population. So we shrank the program down to that level, knowing that's the minimum we could do and still maintain our federal match. That left us, and you get all through with it, an extra $85 million to spend on things that we think, and most people agree, are part of any reasonable program. That's the four things are in the third box. When you put those back on the table, you are now, just for the mandatory population, $127 million or $121 million short. The question is, can we even close the gap for the mandatory population for these? And that's what the second part of this discussion is about. Further discussion is, if we were allowed to use the prioritized list or some other method on this mandatory population, would we be allowed to do that without increasing the population, considering a different climate in this country now than it was 6, 7, 8 years ago, or even 2 or 3 years ago?
Could I just rephrase what I think I heard?
Please, go ahead.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tomei.
So we got the waiver, and I think probably the two physicians here were included in that process. We got the waiver limiting what the mandatories would get, right? Limiting what the
categoricals
get, but expanding the population so that we could get more coverage for more people. Now we are low on money. So we're having to eliminate the people that we had added because of the waivers. Is that true? But because we'd gotten the waiver, now since the waiver is no longer operational, we're going to have to go back and give the categoricals higher services. Is that correct? Is that what I'm hearing?
Actually, the waiver is giving the categoricals a higher level of service than if it was just a pure Medicaid program, and which gets to the point I was trying to make. Under the current waiver, the line is still higher than the mandate levels, and so, which actually shrinks the amount of money that we would have under the current waiver to buy back RX with the budget numbers we're looking at, because the current waiver, even with the dropping the line 10 points, which didn't change a whole lot, we're still buying a benefit package that's roughly 20% higher, or cost 20% more than mandated Medicaid. So the waiver expanded population, but it also bought another set of more services,
right,
for that population,
right,
originally. The new waiver still buys that. It just dropped it, I think, 10 places, didn't it?
10 places,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's still above what we're talking about here in this chart as what we call a mandated Medicaid. The services in this package are less than what is in OHP under the current waiver.
But it would throw out the notion of the higher or lower levels. It would be all of these services for all conditions, because we certainly can't continue the OHP waiver, so we'll go back to basic Medicaid, which would be essentially
that's one option.
These services, whatever they showed up for.
Whatever the covered eligibles are. But Representative Tomei was correct, and Alan went from the theory behind the first waiver that actually did reduce some benefits, expanded the populations, and then Jeff got into OHP2, and what this thing evolved into is where we're actually covering more people with more benefits.
Okay.
All that's out the window.
That's now erased.
So to maybe to summarize then, we're looking at the death of the Oregon Health Plan as we know it.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, phase one. This is
phase
where we,
one of the death.
This is phase one. I mean, this is where we are within existing resources.
Right.
So the question before us is okay, what are we going to do? We're still $127 million short for buying back these, again, Oregon Health Plan, concept, additional benefits. For, in this case, it happens to be,
categorical.
A mandatory population.
Okay.
I mean,
right. And nothing at all for any non-mandatory population.
Right.
So we're still $127 million short of providing what a reasonable Medicaid health plan. That is, by reasonable, I mean having a drug benefit and supplies. We're $127 million short of that, and that means we're untold millions short of helping any non-categorically eligible person that's currently on OHP standard.
Reasonable, at least by our standards.
Right.
I mean, this is the mandatory minimum package is reasonable by federal standards. We will exceed that.
Representative Greenlight.
Is there any state that does that? Remember, that has as minimum as that in the country right now?
I know of no state that does not have a pharmaceutical benefit.
But the state of New Mexico does not have hospitalization in their Medicaid program. So there are.
They got a waiver to.
Yep, they got a waiver that allowed them to drop hospitals.
So it is a possibility. I mean, we could ask for dropping hospitalization, including the rest of the package.
Oh, jeez.
It was. I don't want to sure about New Mexico. But Utah has a waiver that covers primary care only, no subspecialty care, and no hospitalization, and does cover pharmaceuticals. The thinking there being that if you're going to cost shift. which all these programs do, even the best of these programs pays at a low rate that you're car shifting. The thinking there in Utah was put our money into primary care and keep people out of the hospital as much as possible and away from the subspecialists as much as possible, which is more expensive. So in that state, they elected no subspecial care would be paid for, no hospital care would be paid for. That was all to be cost shifted. And the money was put into primary care, pharmaceuticals, to help prevent as much cost shift as they could. And that's their logic behind their program. And then expand, of course, and then pay off being, you expand to a larger population. So those people who were uninsured at least have a primary care coverage and a pharmaceutical coverage instead of having nothing. That's the kind of trade-offs that are being made in this country right now.
Okay. Representative Mona Sanderson. Oh, no. I'm sorry. Representative Merkley. Representative Merkley, would you put your microphone? That's one of the reasons we didn't know you wanted to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we go back to the OHP Plus, and we talked about earlier on in our briefings, we talked about categories of individuals and income levels. I have a memory in my past that in some of those categories of individuals, we had still within OHP Plus gone to higher income levels than absolutely required. With these numbers that you're putting before us today, are we going only to the income levels absolutely required, not anything over? There's nothing extra there. So it is not only does not include, if you will, medically needy and OHP standard, but it's really a reduced form of OHP Plus, just to make sure I'm tracking.
Really the only ads we had in Plus, I think, were women and kids, pregnant women and kids Plus.
That is right, Representative Cruz. Basically what you're seeing in OHP, either Plus or Standard, there were increased benefits, not only for categoricals, but of course the standard population. As an example, we went to approximately 180% in pregnant women, and the requirement for the federal government to have a Medicaid program is 133%. So that's an example of what we did. We asked for what is the minimum basic mandated program by the federal government to get the Medicaid match, and that's what you're looking at.
Down to 50. Yeah.
That's TANF from 100 down to 50% of poverty level. This does not include the SCHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, where we functionally took children at a favored federal match rate, 72 to 28, from 133% of poverty up to 185% of poverty. It does not include one dime for FEOP. I mean, we keep using the words mandatory, federal minimum. You know, that's exactly what we regrettably mean. This is as bare bones as you can get. And that was a theory of, okay, we're just going to start here. We're just going to see where this leads us. I mean, we were all shocked when we came up with the number that this is going to cost, round numbers, you know, $830 million, $840 million. And you look at that gap, you know, which at the time was about 146, and then as we got the revenue forecast and that started going down, I mean, we're now down to about $85 million to do what with? And we came up with those four categories at the bottom: prescriptions, durable medical goods, alcohol and drug, and mental health benefits, which are absolutely critical, and we'll get into that in a few minutes, to the mental health side of this equation. We're still short. How do we get there is the question. So what we have done, again, back on your front sheet, we spent last night's work group. It was a different iteration of what we've done before. We didn't talk policy or points of view. We just came up functionally with a list of questions that we would want answered in two additional work groups for OHP. One to address pharmaceutical savings and efficiencies, and one to address utilization, cost trends, OMAP management. And you can see those basic categories on your front page here
you know, of what we're going to be looking at. The you should also have at your desk a sheet, that a draft sheet that looks from Lynn Reed in OMAP, about 8-10 pages long. And I really want to compliment OMAP and the department for coming up with this concept. And what if you just take the first one? These are the 33 savings, you know, areas of savings. This is everything from reimbursement rates to pharmaceutical savings to different structure, you know, for fee-for-service delivery. You just take the first one, and you can see it's require step therapies for generic drugs. Got a little key here, savings, $2 signs. I mean, just going to save someplace in the neighborhood of $6 to $10 million. But just as important as the dollar figure there is the feasibility. How real is that? And they scored that a high. And then the level of effort to implement. And they scored that a medium. If you go down the list, you can look at feasibility for mail order drugs. Feasibility, low. Level of effort, low. Savings, not very great. This is a pretty comprehensive document, and this is pretty much going to be our roadmap to come up with that $127 million. And that's what we as a committee are going to do. These two work groups, you know, we're going to hone some numbers, we're going to hone the level of effort and the feasibility, and then we're going to bring that down here, and all of us, formal and informal members, I mean, we are going to arm wrestle and come up with what we think is, you know, the best policies to get to that $127 million. If we can get more than that, all the better. Because we haven't bought S-CHIP and we haven't talked about one dime for FEOP yet. S-CHIP's $12 million bucks, covers 20 million kids, or 20,000 kids.
I'd just like to point out that this list from Lynn Reed, it's not the Bible. There are points of contention. In fact, Representative Bates and I were talking about step therapies for 7-Eleven drugs doesn't make necessarily a lot of sense. So, I mean, you know, so this is a point of view from one perspective. I would say most of these are going to have some of them we will drop just because, you know, a lot of effort and no money, why go there sort of thing. But you know, a lot of these will have a fair amount of debate around them before we come to conclusions. So
I think another thing, you know, is the process we've got this by has been very long and hard. And this may look like a confusing document, but it really isn't. And it's the result of a lot of very bright people doing the best they can. Remember, if we are successful in this project, we will have been successful only in recreating a bare-bones Medicaid product. No S-CHIP, no standard, and a lot of pieces missing as far as the health plan would come to know. And the cost shift to the commercial market is significant, with 150,000 people being thrown out as far as health insurance is concerned.
Question?
Representing Monta Sanderson.
With that cost shift, I could envision hospitals closing down. Have the hospitals been at the table on this? Because they're the ones that are going to, I think, have the brunt of the aftermath of these people who aren't going to be covered.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the hospitals, as a general rule, have about 10% of their population in OHP or Medicaid. The burden on them will fall primarily on hospitalized patients and some increases in their ERs, and they will have to deal with that cost shift probably in the commercial market. The question that really has to be asked, and you've asked a very good one, is whether or not that cost shift can now be borne by the commercial market in this state, considering that the commercial market is shrinking from two factors we all know about, some large companies going into self-insured and people dropping out of health insurance because the companies can't afford to buy it for their employees anymore. And that's the reality we face right now. The hospitals have been at the table the entire time for this. Pharma's been there. The pharmacists have been there. I think all parties are there. And they've all kind of taken off their turf hats and looked at this and tried to work in an orderly fashion to deal with it. No one at that table, I believe, is happy with the best product we can come up with. But that's what we have to do. Take it back to Ways and Means for a further discussion. Chair Westland will give us a better understanding, I think, of where he thinks this might go once we've reached, hopefully, the level of at least funding a simple Medicaid program.
And you talk about the shift. I don't mean this as a slam on the hospitals at all, but I am not as worried about the hospitals as I am about the commercial markets and creating what I call the death spiral. I mean, these costs get shifted to the hospitals. We've heard witness after witness at this very witness stand, you know, testify to the fact that those costs are shifted dollar for dollar to the commercial market. Fewer employers, fewer individuals can afford private health insurance. They drop off. Some of their income levels will allow them to go on to the Oregon Health Plan, or no insurance at all, even worse. You know, they go back to the hospitals. Those cost shifts continue to grow, and pretty soon you've decimated the commercial markets. And you look at cost shift. We can focus myopically here in this committee, as we're charged to do, on cost shift, but, you know, big picture, statewide, we're shifting costs in darn near everything we're doing. I don't see any way around it.
Representative Brinkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a variety of ideas that have been talked about around this table, and I just want to get a sense of how a couple of them fit into the plan that we're looking at now. For example, there were discussion of ideas of such as generic-only drug plans or things of that nature to lower the cost of prescription drugs for mandatory populations. Are those types of ideas inherent within the bigger, thicker document that you've laid out, where people have brainstormed over dollars and effectiveness?
Mr. Chair?
Or, for example, a similar idea, just so you can get the drift of where I'm going, discuss kind of the whether certain drugs shouldn't be on it, or a certain least cost-effective drugs, more cost-effective drugs should be preferred over least cost-effective drugs, so on and so forth.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I know. Having been in the minority as long as you have, you're not used to be called Mr. Chair, but I make the transition.
When you're testifying, you often... Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, and then you go ahead.
Well, Representative March, it just seems awfully nice to call you Mr. Chair when you're a Democrat.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Merkley, you'll find the body of this report multiple suggestions on pharmaceuticals, including a generic-only formulary, a bulk purchasing plan through a group called First Health, which is the PBM, which is a pharmacy benefit manager that the state uses for Medicaid. You'll see a suggestion for combining that with a prior authorization to go off the generics onto trades. Tying the preferred drug list to prior authorization when you do go off generics. So all those are being discussed and are part of the discussion that will occur next week, and a rather marathon meeting is being planned to try to wrap this up. You may have to dig through there to find it, but it's in there. Those discussions have all been carried forward and will be probably finalized at the next meeting.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Representative Merkley, do you have ice water delivered to all your committees or just this one? It's a nice service. I just wondered how you...
It's a great service. I'll fill you in on how you can avail yourself of it.
Representative Greenleg.
Not all committees are graced with the quality staff that committee has.
Absolutely.
Thank you. This may be the wrong time to ask this question, and if it is, just tell me to shut up, and we'll talk about it some other time.
Can we move on, Mr. Chair?
You have to rule here. There's been a.
Would you go ahead with your question, and we'll then we'll tell you.
You rule after the question. This 992 converting to 931 million to get back to that middle box came out of the governor's budget, and the governor promised no CSL budgeting, so instead apparently picked some number out of the ether. To create that 992, but now we're taking that 992 minus 10% or something as a gospel number. And if we would have a zero-based budget model, which is what people are asking for, we would ask first the questions: what are the maximums, and build back up to the budget from that. Are we? I sense we're not, because you have different things in your mind, I think, but. But why are we constrained, or why is this a logical beginning point? And is it? I mean, you're iterating back and forth, I sense. It's not.
It's a logical beginning because we are not the Ways and Means Committee, number one, and so we had to have a target. And the only realistic target that exists right now is the governor's budget, because we don't have a co-chair's budget.
Well, but more than that, I would argue that this is a very logical place to start, unless you don't want to seek federal match dollars. Then you start, your zero base is the minimum you can do to receive the federal match, and that's where we've started.
Yeah, that's what I say. You're iterating back and forth from both sides, aren't
yeah.
you?
We could have added the 127 or whatever it was, and said this is the Medicaid minimum, but for the sake of process and what the Ways and Means folks are looking at in the beginning, I mean, they start off with the governor's budget and then do adjustments. Okay, so what we're doing is we came up with what the minimum is to fund Medicaid with these buybacks. And that is weighed off against the governor's budget, which is what we did here. So that gives the Ways and Means folks a point of comparison, kind of a bottom line and a bottom line.
Representative Mr. Jerry Refnos, Greenlink, I think that if I'm following your reasoning, you were offering the possibility of building a budget from the ground up, saying, what's the minimum we can do? What does that cost? That should be the budget. That's zero-based budgeting to a certain degree.
Well, it's one form of zero-based budgeting, but zero-based budgeting takes, in its concept, things from a variety of lines, starts at the bottom, but not necessarily with the absolute minimum. It says this is the, I mean, this could just as easily have started with the population under 100% of the poverty line. When we created the Oregon Health Plan, we started as a bottom line assumption with everybody under 1.0 is really the minimum that we want to serve. And at least as a parallel process here, the same process could take that 1.0 and say, okay, what kind of a package can we get inside Medicaid's allowed things and our own sensibilities about what a minimum package ought to be, starting with everybody up to 100% of the poverty line, and then ask the question we're getting to here, how much short are we if we did that? And we'd obviously be a larger number short than 127 million, but it would seem to me to be a good thing to do as a parallel process. And my guess is that number might be what, 360 million. I'm not sure, but we are a long way down the track, which is why I asked why I suggested this might not be the right time for this question. But I really do think, from a public policy perspective, 100% of the poverty line is not a bad number to at least be looking at in juxtaposition with this number.
Mr. Chair,
to get us about 54% of the poverty line, I think. At least that's what it was in 1990.
No, you go to 100% of the poverty line and you don't qualify for federal minimum Medicaid anymore. I mean, some's below 100%, some's above, like for children.
133.
Sorry,
I understand that, but 100% minimum as a
is what I was what, just as an option, as one possibility.
As one option, you were considering that as a minimum, we hit 100% in all categories, and above that in the mandatory.
Is a required one, yeah.
And that's a number you can select if you wish to, but understand that we had to be kind of pragmatic here. We know fairly realistically what the expectation of the amount of money available for the entire budget is for the next year and a half or 2 years, 2 years, 2003, 2005. Admittedly, we have some worries about the ability to forecast these days, and that's another question. I choke over it too, and but we have to go with something. And what we decided to do is take the governor's budget and before the latest shortfall had already decreased it. You could make a case for decreasing it further. I don't think you really need to. We probably will have 5 to 10% growth over the next 2 years. But you have to be pragmatic somewhere along the line and have a decision made of what you've got available for you and build on what you have available. And that's what we did. Although I understand your position.
Well, actually, your slip of the tongue was probably right on. We have enough for a year and a half, but we have to spread it over 2 years. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking a little bit along the lines that Representative Greenlick was thinking, and that is, If there are several options laid out through your work, it really helps people have a much better sense of where we're at. For example, if we understood, if we keep a plan that looks more or less like the plan we have today, what number does that drive us to? If we go with the very minimum that you've laid out, where does that drive us to? That's been clearly laid out. If there is some intermediate level driven by some logic, and Representative Greenlick gave an example of in those areas where it's below 100% of poverty, going to 100% of poverty, then you kind of have an understanding of three levels. I'm a little uncomfortable with the notion of starting with the assumption that all we have available is what is going to be necessary to cover the minimum. I think we should at least stretch our thinking to ask the question, is it essential or desirable in our society to do more? And if so, should we reach out, should we lay out to people what it would cost to do more and challenge them as to whether they want to come up with the resources or not, rather than starting with the assumption that we won't have any more resources available? And I think if one was lay out two or three levels, then that would be very useful. We may end up having to only be able to go to the lowest level, but I feel like we're surrendering before we've wrestled with the revenue side of do we in our state want to buy a higher level of health care for our people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. First of all, those numbers, those ranges are readily available. If we had costed, and we have costed, but to pay for OHP2 in its current form for the 2003-2005 biennium is $1,200,000,000. We didn't start with the mid-range, if you will, that's a growth from $600 million of general fund that we spent last biennium, general fund and tobacco that we spent last biennium. If what the governor did, and I'm making an assumption here, is trying to have a complete budget, complete as possible, for as complete an Oregon as possible. That obviously includes expenditures for higher ed, K-12, community colleges, Department of Corrections, the Judicial Branch, Commission on Children and Families, State Police. The list is endless, as you know. The governor had to make some difficult decisions, and so he did choose a midpoint. But with regard to where we are and available resources, what we did as a work group is we started, you know, not with any editorial endorsement or validation of federal Medicaid minimum,
We just wanted to know what that costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that number came back at about the 830 range. Our task is to do what's real, not what maybe you want or you think is proper, what I think is proper and prudent. We have to produce a plan and a document that is within existing resources achievable. Is that good public policy? Perhaps not. But is within existing resources, is that the best public policy that we can achieve? That's what the work groups, and then in a very few short days, the purpose of this committee is all about. If you want to talk revenue, if you want to talk, you know, additional funding streams, if you want to talk variations on standard plans, this isn't the place to do that. That's the revenue committee. I don't mean this in a castigating or arm's length fashion, but we are charged with doing what we know we can do. And if we fail, if we reach for that brass ring, if we build the bridge too far and say, this is what we think is proper, and we don't get there, then you are back to a federal minimum Medicaid program with no pharmaceuticals. That makes sense to you?
Well, I understand where you're coming from.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Representative Murphy, let me offer two perspectives on this process. The first perspective is that the budget shortfall has forced us to go into the Oregon Health Plan and not just peel back eligibles. It has forced us to look how we apply the money we have to take care of individuals out there in the real world. It has allowed us or forced us to look at more efficient ways of giving care of these individuals, more effective ways of giving care of these individuals, and that exercise alone has been worth it. We are likely to come out of this with methods and suggestions which will decrease the cost per individual of supplying care to them. That helps us to do the second thing, which if we choose to expand that population again, we can do it in a more efficient fashion and for less money than we would have been doing it 2 years ago. And that is the biggest plus I see of what we're doing here, and it is a very big plus. Second thing that happened was the Oregon Health Plan was predicated most basically on one very simple thing, and it wasn't what a lot of people think it was. It wasn't a matter of prioritizing health care and spreading it out and rationing. It was really about forcing us to have a public debate about Medicaid plans and about health care in general. That's what the Oregon Health Plan really was all about initially, because prior to that time, the decisions about Medicaid were made basically behind closed doors, quietly, and certain categories of people were cut out. We're not going to do transplants. We're going to do, you know, prenatal care, whatever thing you want to take. There was no real debate about it. So this is a part of a continuing debate and discussion that's very open, that has value, and the efficiencies that have already been found and which will come out of these work groups are even more important, because if we do choose to expand the population back out, we could do it in a much more efficient and less costly fashion and still achieve the same results.
Well, Mr. Westland, I'll cut it right to you. Representative Westland, let me put this, and I think this is, I hear this from both camps here, that once we've created the leanest, meanest machine we can in terms of the new Oregon plan.
Mean is probably not a proper word there. But.
Until we are able to cover 122,000 people below the poverty line, I would say we're at the meanest plan we've got just about. When you're covering Medicaid eligible or Medicaid categorical only, we're not at a great plan. But let's say the leanest plan. Once we've developed that leanest plan, I'm hearing from both quarters here, many quarters and myself included, that we would like to price out what we currently are calling, what are currently the Oregon optional populations, which include those individuals and families up to the poverty level, 100% of the poverty level, and then each of those other things. And I hope we can do that so that we can go. So those advocates out there and those of you and us who want to go to the Revenue Committee and say, all right, here is, we've done what we can do with the health plan. Here's what you can buy back if there's revenue, and have that discussion there. But will we be able to cost that out?
The third category of discussion for the work group, which is not on your sheet, but has been on every other sheet, is what we euphemistically call the second rail. This is a one-track, two-rail process. This very difficult, reduce the size and scope in the most humane, efficient manner possible. Functionally, what can you do within existing resources? That's the first rail. The second rail is what can we do additionally, not only in terms of structure, meaning a lot of this is going to have to be approved by the federal government, but the second rail is what is the ideal health care system. We will be doing that after we rush to justice on the first rail. And I would actually even go you one better and say, one of the issues I am most concerned about is shrinking this gap. You push a magic button and all of a sudden produce OHP2, there is still a large gap between commercial policies and those covered by employers and those working individuals, not just working poor. I mean, health insurance has become so expensive. I'd ask us, what are we going to do to close that gap? So the answer to your question is an absolutely.
Okay, Representative Greenlick and then Representative Merkley.
Representative Wesson, do I still have a chit left?
Excuse me?
Do I still have a chit left for a question? I was just checking on my ration of questions you gave me when we started.
You're checking with the wrong person.
But it's getting close, right?
If you ask the wrong question, we'll check the list.
If you keep asking that question, no, you don't.
I must say that I really want to point out that I endorse what you said in terms of needing to do this within a finite limit. And I really endorse what Representative Bates said in terms of the direction you're moving and the enormous progress that's obviously being made by taking this approach. But what I was pushing at before, and of course I was taught to watch out for the third rail when I went to New York, because that was always the one I needed to watch out for. The original health plan was a balancing of three things. It was a balancing of the population, the benefits, and the reimbursement rates. And we started out with the assumption that we would pick a population, we would agree to full reimbursement, and we would create a benefit package based on that wonderful public discussion. That was a extremely important public discussion. And that if it needed more money, we would get more money. And we, in fact, needed $300 million more money, which in those days was, I guess, like a billion now. So I think it makes sense to say, okay, we have, let's say, this $1 billion that's on your front page, $1.6 billion, give or take a little bit. $1.06 billion, give or take a little bit. But I was stimulated by the notion of how other choices have been made in other states. And when we start with going to the minimum
benefit to the minimum population, we're already creating sort of an answer to the question. It's a constraint that you don't necessarily need to start with, and we could have started with, we'll cover everybody up to 1.0 of the poverty line as a minimum, and the $1 billion, and now what do we do to make that package work? I mean, there are various ways that we could have approached the absolute minimum from which we want to build up. And I was just probing a little bit, dealing with that absolute minimum at a population threshold that's slightly different from the Medicaid-only population threshold. And I just wonder whether there is time yet to consider that as a, or to throw that in the mix as you're moving down that second rail.
When it gets to the second rail, absolutely. But I would take some umbrage at your characterization that the Oregon Health Plan was based on three principles, which I agree with.
There
was a fourth. Three key words: within available resources.
No, actually, it wasn't. The governor at that time gave us the commitment that if we did the population at 1.0 and did the full reimbursement and used a cut on the service level that was at the minimum, if it required more money, he would go to the legislature to get it. And it did turn out requiring $300 million more that he put a lot of political chips in to go get. And I'm not suggesting we do that now, but he put the constraints on the full reimbursement, the 100% of the poverty level, and then some social determination of what a minimum benefit package was.
Well, I don't know why, and it's tough to argue with a guy who was actually there and wears green sweaters. But I don't know why.
Totally failed.
I don't know why we would have the feature of moving the line.
Mr. Chair, I was also there.
We moved the line.
And we did move the line as far as the federal government would let us, but they didn't let us move very far. And the plan was laid out within financial resources at that time because the governor was able to go to the legislature and receive more money. That was 10 years ago or more, or thereabouts, and the financial situation of the state, unfortunately, was much different, or fortunately, was much different then than it is now. I think one of the things that surprised me in this, and maybe if I share this with you, it will make you feel a little more comfortable. When you start out asking what a bare absolute minimum would look like, I expected and hoped that we have then about $300 to $400 million left to decide not how much to buy back from the point of view of pharmaceuticals for this population, but how much of the population we could buy back in standard. I was stunned the second or third night into this when we finally got those numbers together and found we didn't have enough money to even buy back the basic package these people deserve to have. That was a stunning moment for me. In fact, I went home that night and reworked the numbers three or four times because I couldn't believe it. Okay? When you don't have enough money in the budget to maintain a mandatory plan and are at risk of losing your Medicaid match, that is a real wake-up call. Should more resources be sent to this group? That's a question for the entire Ways and Means and this entire body to decide. If, in fact, we have no new revenue at this time, we have to budget against that, then where do you want to take the money from? You want to take it from K-12 and bring it over? You want to bring it from higher ed, public safety? That's the kind of choices we are now facing, and that's the kind of decisions that will have to come out of the entire legislative body in the next 6 to 8 weeks. And we're all going to be part of that discussion, I'm sure. But I would tell you, the moment that surprised me the most was when I saw these figures come out and realized how deeply the revenue had affected us and how bad a position we were in.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. I'm thinking about a number of people who have been through my office who are on the medically needy list, and as we've noted, they're better off, if you will, in terms of their income than those in OHP standard, and OHP standard is better off than those in OHP plus. But what these folks told me An example would be a fellow who said his income was approximately $700 a month or something like that. I wouldn't want to swear exactly what it was, but that he also spent $700 a month on his medicines. And he indicated something that probably has been addressed here, but I think I may have missed it, and that is the fact that his drug therapies are a draw against his income he can't take into account when qualifying for the Oregon Health Plan. So essentially his income is zero, but he can't get on the Oregon Health Plan. Someone like that is basically, if we go back to this type of structure, if in fact those facts are correct, which I'm sure you'll all be able to tell me if they are or not, is basically in an awful situation. They will have zero to live on, because they're at, or less than zero because their medical costs will exceed their income. I don't know the logic of not being able to draw your necessary to live medical costs against your income when calculating whether you can qualify for this plan. But if that's correct, I mean, this is just not okay.
He's a loss for words.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
I don't think any of us who have worked in this think this is okay. This is not okay. But we were charged with doing a job. That job is completed, will show us a much more efficient way of delivering health care to the population. The question then will arise of whether we want to extend that to a larger population, continuing those efficiencies. And that would allow us to do it at less cost than under the old plan. I'm not saying this is okay, and I'll make that very clear, this is not okay. But this is the beginning of that conversation, and I think that's what Chair Westland has tried to tell us here today, is we've got this basic work done. We're going to show the most efficient way of delivering these programs to the people affected. The question then becomes, do we expand that? And if we do, how do we go about doing that?
Thank you.
If I might, Mr. Chair, we have obviously moved past, I think, just a report on how far the work group has taken us. And what we have really begun here is the very healthy conversation as to, you know, perspectives, philosophy, role, placement and prioritization of government services. And I agree with Representative Merkley. You know, it is not good. In fact, it's horrible. And it's not okay that Portland is shortest school year in the nation. It's not good. You know, it's not acceptable that qualified higher ed professors are leaving this state in droves because of our current budget crisis. But there is a difference in those two, as critical and as vital as they are, you know, to Oregon's fabric and our culture and our society. There's a critical difference between it not being okay to allow people to die and not being okay for a shorter school year. And I think all three of us at this dais, and I hear in your comments, Representative Merkley, share a deep belief in that basic philosophy. The challenge before us, before this committee, is A, what can we best do on this first rail? And then secondly, more importantly, what can we do on that second rail?
Any other further questions?
No.
No, you have a lot of work before you. All right. Mental health stakeholder report.
Yeah, that's our good news.
Yes.
The mental health stakeholders group had a similar challenge, come up with the best ideas to deliver mental health system within, again, a given resource number. That was $475 million. Mental health is a lot more complicated. When you have the health plan,
you functionally have the same apple with a fairly standardized delivery system and a lot of the same players dancing around that same apple. Hospitals, docs, the contractors, pharmacists, drug companies, the everyone knows everyone's issues. Everyone is pretty comfortable disagreeing with somebody else. That is the antithesis for the mental health delivery system. A lot of the people in that room, you know, we're meeting one another for the first time. There are 14 different funding streams for mental health. You know, there are functionally, as we learned so well yesterday, and I don't know about the committee, but I thought actually yesterday was one of our best hearings when we had the two gentlemen, one from the Central Oregon MHO and the Lane County MHO, come in and talk about the fact that the entire state of Oregon geographically is covered by an MHO, unlike OHP, which doesn't enjoy that luxury, if you will. The and then right beside that you lay county mental health services, and then right beside that delivery system you lay A&D delivery services, and if you really want to complicate the mix, you can lay the Oregon Health Plan beside that delivery system. I'm actually very proud of the group in the last couple of meetings dealing with these very, you know, draconian issues. We have actually started to take a couple baby steps forward, and it all revolves around, you know, decentralizing services provided out of the state hospital, leaving the forensic population there, those criminally committed, and sending down to the local level, you know, most of the dollars that would otherwise be, you know, allocated to the state hospital. I mean, that's about where we've gotten to. We have temporarily suspended the mental health work groups because part of their decision-making process depends on if we're able to buy back the chemical dependency and mental health services that we've pointed out in the box at the bottom of the first page we were talking about. So we're making progress there. It's slow, and it's actually, I think, much more complex than an already extraordinarily complex subject, and that is, of course, the Oregon Health Plan.
Anything you'd like to add, Dr. Bates?
Just a few comments. Chair Westland summed up a very complex and long problem, or a long process, extremely well. One thing that I think several of us have taken away from the process is that while it's fairly easy to take someone's appendix out, follow them for 2 or 3 weeks afterwards and say goodbye and things are going to be fine the rest of their lives, as far as that appendix is concerned, mental health is a long-term chronic disease you have to treat. And it takes what we call wraparound services. By that I mean it is not just a matter of giving the patient medication to take and seeing them 6 months later. You have to constantly monitor that patient day in and day out. And you have to be ready to pick them up if they're in a crisis situation and if they have had a mental break in our emergency room. Your job is to keep them out of the hospital and keep them functioning in society. That means checking on them almost daily and making sure that they're taking their medications, making sure that they're not living under a bridge, making sure they're not getting into alcohol and drug problems at the same time and not becoming criminals because of their mental illness. That is a different type of delivery system by far than a simple medical health system. Hugely different. Certain parts of the state are actually doing that fairly effectively. Other parts are having some difficulty and struggling. They all take a great deal of money to make that happen appropriately, and they are going to be strapped not to do this. This is going to be another problem of cost shift. Cost shift a little differently than what we've seen in the physical side. This will be a cost shift into our schools, a cost shift into our criminal justice system, and a cost shift into, frankly, our way of life and how we view ourselves. I know that's kind of a theoretical picture, but that also is very real. the ability to access these funds and use them most efficiently is still being questioned in some parts of the state, but it's being, I think, for the first time questioned in a global manner and in a reasonable manner by the work groups and by this committee. And I think coming out of this will be the same situation on physical health. You'll see more efficiency and better programs as a result.
Let me ask one question in that regard, and you talked about the state mental state hospital, Oregon State Hospital. The one of the current problems, as I've expressed, is that there is insufficient room at the inn currently at Oregon State Hospital. That local jurisdictions who have committed, gone through the process, or they have a mentally ill person in the jails, don't have a place to send them because there's not enough room. Are we going to, you know, is there any way that we're looking at that part of the problem?
I think Barry Cast, Director of Mental Health, would be the first to acknowledge that this is a fairly risky strategy, but his assessment is the same as mine, and that is it holds less risk than defunding to the extent of losing critical mass the county funding streams. He would still have capacity, indeed, he would actually have more capacity if he shipped some of these patients to the local level, because you can argue maybe not all those folks really need to be there. Now, in that assessment, obviously some people that do need to be there will end up back there, and that would then be the county's responsibility. But this is not without, you know, some concern and risk.
We're talking about with risk is financial risk, not necessarily risk to the patient per se. And it's the financial risk if they're placed in a community setting and then they're released and they end up in jail, the county's stuck with that. But what we're looking at from the perspective of the state hospital is there's probably at least short term, not much we do with the forensic population there. But if you include Eastern Oregon Psych Unit, we've got 260 civil commitment folks, and we think it's reasonable to assume in our discussion that 75% of those could probably do very well in a community setting, and not only would they do well in that setting, but if they're in group homes, we can get Medicaid match. And so one of the things we're looking at is an aggressive way to start placing some of those in communities, because some of that can happen in the existing structure. Not all of it, but some of it. So, you know, the whole purpose behind doing that not only is, there's a patient care issue there, but the fact is that if we can shift as many of those folks as is appropriate to community settings and get the federal match, that frees up general fund dollars for the rest of the community-based system.
Well, I agree that there's certainly patients within the Oregon State Hospital that do not belong there. They belong in community treatment. However, there are mentally ill in the jails who have harmed themselves because they cannot get adequate treatment.
Okay, and I guess on the front end we're saying the status quo is what it is, and we really didn't have resources or really haven't thought about what we do about those people that have been sentenced. The objective of what we would like to create, if we indeed create a new model, is a community-based system that keeps those people out of the legal system in the first place.
Thank you. Well,
sometimes there is the curse of memory, and that's a
I've never
that's a problem as you get to my age, and this conversation sounds so familiar. We closed Damish. We closed all those hospitals. And the promise was we'd build a community mental health system to take care of those people because it was appropriate to do. We closed the hospitals and then never built. I mean, that's why where we are now. So it sounds like I hear Barry Cass saying the solution is to make that same mistake again.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Bates.
Can I respond to that? I understand your concerns and fears, but in fact, this is one time that's not probably going to occur. The reason I say that is because this has already been piloted in several counties and has worked extremely well. Group homes of less than 16 beds are funded by the federal government at a 2-to-1 match, and the reason is they like the policy. They like the policy much better than large central state hospitals because it is better for the patients. We've done that already in the state over the last 5 or 6 years. We need to accelerate that program. That was a recognition. That would also allow opening up of the state hospital for those patients that really needed it. Representative March, in your particular case, that patient might never have gone to jail in the first place, or if he had, he may have been sent to a residential care facility in Portland with never having gone to the state hospital. But choices would have been available that were much more effective and cost, not more effective for the patient, but more cost effective. The cost of the state hospital is really truly staggering. Of the $400 million that is sent to the counties for their systems of care, about or is designated from that, approximately $260 or $280 million goes to the state hospital. It's a very expensive operation to run and not always in the best interest of patients, and for the most part gets no federal match. So to move people from there into a more appropriate setting for them is appropriate and good. There are some risks to it. Those risks involve whether or not you're taking people out of the state hospital, sending them to a less secure situation that might be dangerous for them. We think we can deal with that, but there is some policy questions there that have to be looked at very carefully.
Well, I share Representative Greenlick's concerns in that we always tend to find the community solution idea because it's a cost saver only when we don't have the money. I think that probably is. Do you want to add something?
I think, is another problem that presents an opportunity. And it allows us, hopefully, at the end of the day, to get to some best management practices. The one thing about, I was on the governor's mental health work group 2 interims ago that created a study about that thick that I went to every meeting, and I can understand that. So, but what that points out is we have an incredibly complicated system that can be simplified to a large degree. And streamlining, simplification is going to help a lot. We looked at the matrix we saw yesterday from Lane County. You know, there's a lot of stuff there, you know, but part of it is the different ways different things connect. The one thing we heard from everybody in the work group was that recommendation number one is simplify. You know. And so at the end of the day, I think we were going to come up with a better delivery system.
Well, great. If problems bring opportunity, Oregon's the land of opportunity.
Mr. Chair, my philosophy has always been when everybody else is circling the wagons, it's the best time to attack.
He got that from Custer.
Yeah, I think he's on the wagon.
All
right. Any closing remarks?
Two, Mr. Chair. Thank you. An important comment, and that is, I just like to emphasize that the systems that we are designing during this time of crisis will serve us well, and we will be able to do more with more when we really do get to that light at the end of the proverbial tunnel. I mean, this is our opportunity. I mean, this is what's keeping me going through all of this. So I, I, I would encourage everyone to look at what we are doing when we, and we, quite frankly, we started it today, when we get to discussing, you know, the policies and systems surrounding this budget shortfall. The second announcement is that this is the first night that Representatives Cruz, Bates, and myself, as well as Mr. Berkovian, you know, have not been in one of these work groups in 3 weeks. So in celebration, Representative Bates asked me to invite all of you to dinner.
What?
A restaurant of his choice. He's buying.
All right.
I'll meet the spaghetti factory. It's
a, no, that's a, I thought you were going to invite us to the dye house where the cattlemen were.
And the mill will be on me.
And I,
you and I, you big.
I will leave it to the committee to decide whether you met the Dupreet Goldberg Rocky King standard or not. And if, seeing no further questions, I will call the committee to end and adjourn.
6:30, Spaghetti Factory, those are...